guitar up.
One.
Today in the studio, it's part two of the definitive double disc set, Southern Rock Gold.
You know, losing Tommy to Marshall Tucker was devastating to that group. If you knew that group, you'd know how important he was.
Oh, of course I know those people, sure.
Well, and his brother was the more musical, creative force in the band, but Tommy led that band in a way that band never wandered off track. They were always on the money and always in the right groove. And losing Ronnie, obviously, artistically was spelled the end of that band in many ways. And losing Dwayne Allman and Barry Oakley, and I mean, it did thrust Dickie as a songwriter and as a singer and as a guitarist to the front, and it certainly, you know, underscored Greg's contribution to the group. But it was impossible to recover from all of that, and there wasn't enough heart, soul, or talent in the idiom to withstand that kind of blow, because
those guys were one of a kind, man.
Hi, I'm Greg Allman.
And I'm Dickie Betts with the Allman Brothers Band.
And you're in the studio.
Hi, I'm Jerry Eubanks.
And I'm Doug Gray, and you're in the studio with the Marshall Tucker Band.
I'm Gary Rossington in the studio for Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Hi, this is Donnie Van Zandt of 38 Special.
This is Jeff Carlisi from 38 Special in the studio.
Hi, I'm Henry Paul of the Outlaws.
Southern Rock Gold, Part 2.
Somebody pointed out the uncanny parallels between the original Southern rock musical movement of the 1970s, typified by the Allman Brothers and Marshall Tucker bands, plus Lynyrd Skynyrd, with the grunge movement 20 years later. And I must agree that the coincidences are eerily similar. Each grew out of a very specific region of the country, Southern rock coming from the American Southeast, with grunge from the Pacific Northwest. Each had about a 10-year period of popularity. And both the original Southern rock bands and the Seattle grunge leaders like Nirvana and Alice in Chains would be undone ultimately by the sudden tragic deaths of their leaders. Greg Allman and his older brother Dwayne were at the creative epicenter of the Southern rock genesis in Daytona Beach, Florida, forming the Allman Brothers Band in March 1969 with a repertoire of blues standards by Muddy Waters, T-Bone Walker, and Willie Dixon, augmented with originals by 21-year-old Greg Allman. Here's Greg with me in the studio.
I had written Midnight Rider, and it came to me like all of a sudden. I think maybe less than 45 minutes, I had it finished. I was staying in this house. My brother was staying with this girl that he knew, right? He was like crashing there, and she had a baby. I didn't know where I was. I woke up in the middle of the night with this tune in my head, and I couldn't find the light switch. So I found this ironing board and this box of kitchen matches, right? So I would strike one match and then strike another and blow it out, and I wrote it on this ironing board cover with the charcoal. I'd light the match and blow it out. So, yeah, I'd get about 1.5 words out of each match, you know. So I caught mucho hell for it the next day when she woke up and found her ironing board cover all ruined. But there it was, you know, and at least I had it all down. So the next morning I copied it down on paper. By nightfall we had learned it and had it all the way down. I wonder where that ironing board cover is today. I'd like to have it back, really. It almost felt like I had nothing to do with it after it was written. I mean, it was like being wonderfully possessed.
That's Midnight Rider, written and sung by Greg Allman, now on Southern Rock Gold. That haunted version from Greg's first solo album, Laid Back, in 1973, has an aching vocal and lonesome arrangement that the original Allman Brothers Band version in 1970 did not. The reason? By the time he recorded his 1973 solo album, both the Allman Brothers Band's bass player, Barry Oakley, and Greg's big brother, Dwayne Allman, one of rock's greatest slide guitar players, had both died in separate motorcycle accidents. Even though the next two Allman Brothers Band albums were their most successful, Dickie Betts and Greg Allman told me it was a tortured time.
You know, the Eat a Peach record was pretty strange to us because that's when Dwayne was killed, right in the middle of that recording. So, you know, we kind of went through a whole lot of stuff, you know, with that.
That changed the arrangement of the songs. It was like two different projects.
Yeah.
We used some of it on each one. That was a strange time back then.
By 1975, the Allman Brothers Band, Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Marshall Tucker Band, and the Charlie Daniels Band, they were all selling millions of albums and hundreds of thousands of concert tickets. Every record label felt they had to have a Southern rock band in their stable or miss out. Now, that greatly benefited a fledgling three-guitar band from Tampa, Florida called the Outlaws, led by Huey Thomason and Henry Paul. The late Huey Thomason goes first.
As far as Greengrass and High Tides goes, that song took a couple of years to actually develop into what it ended up being on the record. We played it, and it was short to start with. It didn't have the long guitar solos at the end, and we just kept working on it, and the solos would get a little bit longer and a little bit longer, and, you know, eventually we found things that worked, and we got rid of the things that didn't. I also want to say that over the years, when we first started Greengrass and High Tides, it was like a 3.5-4 minute ballad, and we kept adding this outro onto it and this tempo change. And over the years in the clubs, we generated all these real cool little musical moves, mostly on the lead guitar part, but the band would follow it dynamically, where there'd be these giant dropouts of music and energy, and it would just suck the crowd into the band's music because it was so dynamic and so tight and rehearsed. And after Paul got done editing down the final version of the record, we literally had to go out and relearn it, you know, to kind of accommodate what we wound up with, because there were signature sections in the song and we had to kind of go back and sort of rethink the wheel a little, because we had played it one way for so long, and then in a couple slices of the razor blade, we had another whole sort of arrangement on our hands. But it was very concise, condensed, and
compressed,
and accurate from the standpoint of importance. So that was the long life and the many different phases of that song becoming an FM radio classic.
Place you only dream of, where your soul is always free. Silver stages, golden curtains, filled by head plate as could be. As a rainbow grew around the sun, all my stars of love and God came from somewhere beyond the sea to see. These lovely people played just for me. If I bid you see this place where stories all ring true, will you let me pass your face to see what's really you? It's not for me, I ask this question as though I were a king. Boy, you have to love, believe, and feel before the burst of tambourines take you there.
Green grass and high clouds forever, castles of stone sold in glory. Faces say we adore you, as kings and queens bow and play for you.
Thank you.
myself amongst the music and the rhyme that it gets you there.
Green grass and high tides forever. Castles and stones hold in glory. Lost faces say we adore you. As kings and queens bow and pray for you.
Outlaws with Green Grass and High Tides from their 1975 debut. written and sung by Huey Thomason, who passed away in September 2007. Up next, Doug Gray of the Marshall Tucker Band and Gary Rossington of Lynyrd Skynyrd join me, Redbeard, in the studio for more of Southern Rock Gold, Part 2. Welcome back in the studio for Part 2 of Southern Rock Gold. I'm Redbeard. By the mid-1970s, Southern Rock was in its heyday, which also made it a big target for some Yankee music critics who equated the virtually all-white players, thick Southern drawls, cowboy hats and boots, with racism. Marshall Tucker Band lead singer Doug Gray found such nonsense amusing.
Everybody said, Marshall Tucker Band's crazy. They've got B.B. King opening for it. That was my idea. I wanted B.B. King. You know, had B.B. King. And then we got up there and could not believe it. The audience loved it. See, so there's a closeness there. Me listening to WLAC every night, because that was the only station you could pull in. All the rest of them would go off. Out of Nashville was where LAC was. But that was the only thing you get. Jerry and I going to the black clubs up through there. Me going to be the only white guy to listen to James Brown in Spartanburg, South Carolina. He'd play every other weekend, and I'd go sit in the clubs and or the auditorium and listen. And there's a little place called the White House that you could go at 1 o'clock in the morning, and somehow you'd go up there, and they'd be selling liquor.
We'd be the only white boys in
there. and could get away with it, yeah. Because they knew our intentions. You know, they knew our intention was basically to listen to the music, and that was what it was. And, you know, and so we grew up with basically a black background. And that goes back to the story of putting B.B. King on there, because B.B. King wasn't hot at that point in time. And so we got him, like, reasonable enough to open the shows for us. And everybody said, man, this is crazy. All the promoters around the country. And I'm saying it is part of music.
Long enough for my boots to get old. We've been together so long now, they both need me so. If I ever settle down, you'd be my kind, and that's a good time for me to hit on down the line. Hurting in a
Couldn't stand to see you cry. I'd stay another year if I saw a teardrop.
will. I was born a wrangler and a rounder, and I guess I always will. Heard it in a love song. Heard it in a love song. Heard it in a love song. Can't be wrong.
Originally on the 1977 album Carolina Dreams, that's the Marshall Tucker Band's biggest hit, Heard It in a Love Song, now included on the two-disc Southern Rock Gold Anthology. By 1977, the Southern Rock band that had pushed to the forefront was Lynyrd Skynyrd, on its way eventually to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Lynyrd Skynyrd had a bare-knuckle approach that Gary Rossington says went back to their formative days.
Back then, we just kind of wrote with a vengeance and wrote real hard, mean stuff. I remember Rodney Mills on our first album used to say, every time you guys come in here to play, y'all act like you're mad. Because we just played real hard, you know. I think by then we'd gotten Leon was there too. And it changed bass players, and back in those days, the PA was just for the singer. Everybody didn't come through the PA, you know, so yeah. We wanted the drums to be louder out front, yeah. So the people could hear a strong boom beat, and so we had double drummers, like the Allman Brothers, really, but our drummers kind of played harder. The Allmans were more of a beat. During that time also, Ricky Medlock was around in those days playing drums. We had double drummers. Bob Burns and Ricky Medlock both played drums at the same time for us for 2 years, just so we could be a lot stronger.
from Southern Rock Gold. That's Blackfoot with Highway Song, written and sung by former Lynyrd Skynyrd drummer Ricky Medlock, who later switched to guitar and vocals when he formed Blackfoot. Next, more tragedy strikes at the heart of Southern Rock mainstays, but in the 80s, a whole second generation of bands will carry on. Members of the Outlaws and the Marshall Tucker Band are joined by 38 Special and Steve Earle, with me, Redbeard, in the studio. And coming up, I have the world premiere of the unreleased Outlaws album, entitled Always an Outlaw, the final spectacular music recorded just days before the sudden death of Huey Thomason in September 2007. I'm Redbeard. That's next in the studio for Southern Rock Gold Part 2. The October 1977 charter plane crash that killed Lynyrd Skynyrd leader Ronnie Van Zant and two other band members, plus severely injured practically every member of Lynyrd Skynyrd, effectively ended that band's original era. In 1980, the Marshall Tucker Band was the third major Southern rock band to suffer a tragic loss to a key member, this time bass player Tommy Caldwell, younger brother of Marshall Tucker Band's lead guitarist and songwriter Toy Caldwell. Here are Doug Gray and Jerry Eubanks of the original Marshall Tucker Band.
With Tommy, he might not understand you sometime, but at least he'd sit there and listen. And he learned a lot from me. I was like a big brother there for a while. And then he went on to become himself. You know, and through the years he got married, he wanted to be stronger. He wanted to be a better songwriter. He would have continued to be one of the key players in this whole band right now. This band would still be, the original band probably would have still been around. That's the way I look at it.
Tommy was the spiritual leader of the band.
Right.
He was the one with the driving dream, you know? Yeah. That he, and a lot of times everybody else went along with Tommy's dream, you know? Dude, he was just that kind of person.
Just
he was
for the sake, because we were positive about
him. He was an inspirational kind of person. If he believed in something, he could, you just knew it was right if he believed in it. I was at the studio.
Yeah,
I
think we both were at the studio, and they called us.
In Spartanburg. We had a studio down there for about 5 years, and we were there.
We had just gotten off the road, and we had just played Nassau Coliseum, which we have a live tape of. We had done an interview with Cherry Bomb Magazine the day before, but we made a picture, the last group picture that was ever made with that Cherry Bomb girl, okay? And we were standing out there at the Island Inn in New York. That I remember that real well. And then we got on the bus that night. We played, got on the bus that night, and was home the next day. And I think Tommy was going down to the health club and work out, and he ran into the back of a waterworks truck, flipped him up on the side. He hit his head, and they didn't expect him to live from the word go. But anyway, they called us at the studio, and so we went down to the hospital. And I'm not sure how long that lasted.
He died like two or three days later.
It
was a while.
It was something
But he never regained consciousness, you know.
It was hard on Toy. And
it was hard on everybody.
It was really hard on Toy because just prior to that, brother. He just lost two brothers.
Within a month, he lost two brothers.
Charlie Daniels talks about the Caldwell brothers, Toy and Tommy, of Marshall Tucker Band in the studio.
He's a strong bass player. Played with his thumb like Toy does.
Yeah, yeah. How does Toy burn off those leads without a
pick? That's just the way he came up playing. His dad, their dad's name is Toy. He's Toy Jr. And their dad plays guitar, and he played that way. I've never seen, he never would play when I'm around. Mr. Caldwell never would for some reason or another. I've always wanted to hear him play, but he never would. But anyway, that's the way he played, and Toy and Tommy started playing that way. Tommy first started playing guitar before he switched to bass. And they started playing that way with their thumb. And it's, you know, Wes Montgomery played that way. Just that old thumb banging.
I never knew that.
Yes, sir. And he could move with it, too. I mean, you know, like Toy can. Toy's got a fastest thumb in the West, pardon the pun. But he has. He just, he really cooks with it. He moves that thumb like somebody else moves a guitar pick, you know. He's just moving it back and forth across the strings. It takes some years to get to where you could do that.
I should say so.
And Tommy did the same thing with the bass with his thumb. This is a poem that I wrote it's a dedication on the back of the Full Moon album. It's dedicated to Tommy Caldwell from the entire CDB family, and the title of it is To a Friend. And it goes, I guess us who take the highway are a different breed of men. with a special kind of feeling for the ones who we call friend. For the long road seems to bind us as we share a common load, and the lonely miles behind us make us brothers of the road. It's an arm around your shoulder when the morning comes too soon, and a late night conversation in 1,000 motel rooms. It's a flood in California or a snowstorm in St. Paul. And it takes a tough old soldier to keep going through it all. But we're so much less than human when we lose one of our own. Now there's one more empty saddle. This old cowboy has gone home.
Henry Paul and Huey Thomason of the Outlaws, who himself died suddenly in September 2007, wrote the obituary of the original Southern rock era from 1969 through 1980.
You know, Marshall Tucker lost Tommy, who was really the heart and soul and leader of that group. The Allman Brothers had lost Wayne and Barry, and there was some, you know, struggle for control personally, individually in that group. And so, I don't know, the whole Southern rock fraternity was knocked on its hind end by
turned
it all.
Up, yeah, turned upside down.
It was just like a 1-2-3 punch, and it was like, wow.
Wow.
You know, losing Tommy to Marshall Tucker was devastating to that group. If you knew that group, you'd know how important he was to
it. Oh, his of course I know those people, sure.
Well, and his brother was the more musical, creative force in the band, but Tommy led that band in a way that band never wandered off track. They were always on the money and always in the right groove. And losing Ronnie, obviously, artistically was spelled the end of that band in many ways. And losing Dwayne Allman and Barry Oakley, and I mean, it did thrust Dickie as a songwriter and as a singer and as a guitarist to the front. And it certainly, you know, underscored Greg's contribution to the group. But it was impossible to recover from all of that, and there wasn't enough heart, soul, or talent in the idiom to withstand that kind of blow, because
those guys were one of a kind, man. And all of them.
And the individual respective groups took such a devastating loss by the deaths of these people that it was just about like going in there and knocking out the heavyweight champion of the world like repeatedly, and he just couldn't get up from it.
But as it turned out, the original Allman Brothers and Marshall Tucker bands, along with Lynyrd Skynyrd, had inspired a whole second generation of bands by the 1980s. One of them, Jacksonville-based 38 Special, even had the Van Zant pedigree in singer-songwriter Donnie Van Zant, a younger brother to the late Lynyrd Skynyrd lead singer-songwriter. In spite of the plane crash, Donnie Van Zant says it made 38 Special more determined than ever.
The main thing with 38 Special, it made us want to go on. You know, we wanted to, to just continue to do what we were doing, you know, except I wanted to be better at it now. You know, I was really proud of what Ronnie did for the music scene and what Skynyrd did, you know, and it just made 38 a stronger band. You know, we just were determined to make it, you know, and to make him proud of us and keep that banner going for the South there. That would be some hard shoes to fill right there, you know. I could never do that, you know. If I could only do a quarter of what he did, I'd be real happy. But I think 38 Special, after, you know, 2 or 3 years after the crash and all that, did keep the banner going, you know, for the South. You know, we were the only bands from the South that we were the only band from the South that was doing anything, you know. And I just think that we after our second record, went back and regrouped and you know, and just really looked at what we were doing musically and realized that there was a change happening music-wise, radio-wise, everything-wise, you know. So we kept our ears and eyes open and changed a little bit there, and it paid off for us.
Realize what you had.
38 Special's Hold On Loosely from 1980's Wild-Eyed Southern Boys, included on Southern Rock Gold. Strangely, the Van Zandt connection turned out to be a double-edged sword for 38 Special when some rock critics copped an attitude that the band must be trying to skate by on the rep of Donnie's deceased older brother's Lynyrd Skynyrd legacy, according to 38 Special lead guitarist Jeff Carlisi.
From the beginning, when Skynyrd was touring and were already a very big band, and we had our first record out, reviews and critics and what have you really didn't embrace us like we thought that they would. Basically, what they said was, this is just someone trying to follow in the footsteps of Big Brother's band, just another Southern rock band, nothing very positive about it. And they were probably, I mean, right in the sense of we weren't very good at the time because we were young and green, but that's all part of learning and molding your sound to become what you hope a lot of people would like. So after the tragedy, I don't really recall at that point saying, okay, now it's up to you guys, because we hadn't proved anything on our own yet as far as being successful, having a hit song, selling records, all of the above. But I noticed that you saw a little bit of it starting after our third album, which was the Rocking Into the Night album. But with Wild-Eyed Southern Boys, and this was, of course, 4 years later, I guess, 77, 81, yeah, roughly 4 years later, all of a sudden, that was the time that I remember people saying, the torch has been passed. It's happened now. And we were the Southern band that typified what Southern music was at that time.
And it was the last half of the 1980s when a highly significant tributary of the Southern rock movement would spring off that is very vibrant to this day, the no-depression, alt-country Americana sound that can be traced back to a handful of musical rebels like Texas native Steve Earle, whose father and grandfather were determined that baby Steve would be born on Texas soil. Except Mom was with Steve's dad on an army base in Virginia when the stork came. Here's Steve Earle.
He became so upset by the situation that he got a Prince Albert can full of dirt from his pasture. Actually, my dad's from Jacksonville, Texas, which isn't that far from here, about 100 miles from here. And he got some dirt from his pasture and put his youngest son, who had never been out of Jacksonville, Texas in his life, on the train and sent him to Virginia. The original plan was they wanted it under the table when I was born, and this great big huge army nurse prevented that, and so they settled for just sticking my feet in the dirt. And so I've got a picture of my dad sticking my feet in this dirt. They poured it out on a dinner plate and stuck a little sign in it that said Texas. I did the same thing with both of my boys when they were born, because they both were born in Tennessee.
How did the route get you to Tennessee? I know you were talking about the first time you saw Doc Watson in Nashville. How long ago was that?
1974. I left San Antonio. I dropped out of school when I was 16 and just started, you know, I was playing coffee houses mostly because I couldn't, you know, I wasn't old enough to play in places that serve liquor. So, I was basically a folk singer. And I was real lucky in that I had access to some really, really great writers firsthand. Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt. And that's what's funny, that, you know, when I first started getting played like on country radio, it was like everybody like sort of like acted like I had sprung full grown from the brow of Jimmy Bowen in 1986. And it was, and they always talked about me and Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis in the same breath. And if anything, I'm a straggler from what was going on in Austin and Nashville in the mid-70s. I had good teachers, Guy, Towns, Jerry Jeff Walker. It was, you know, B.W. Stevenson. And it was all about singer-songwriters. And when I first got to Nashville, on any given night, you could go to, like, Guy's house or John Lomax used to do, you know, parties at his house. And you'd have everybody from the street level where I was up to and including Newberry and Neil Young, you know, and the guitar going around. So it was a good place to learn. And then basically cocaine, sort of created a caste system and killed that real fast, you know. But it was like, in those days, you know, it was like it was a lot more open, and I miss that a lot. This one, you know, I'll probably live in Nashville from here on out. It's gotten to be home. And I actually bought a house. I'm halfway respectable and pay taxes and everything. Well, you know, the funny thing about it is there have always, you know, like occasionally over the years, there have been a lot of great rock records made in Nashville, sometimes on purpose and sometimes by accident. I mean, I don't think the Everly Brothers knew that they were making pop records. I think they thought they were making hillbilly records for kids.
And, right.
And it just, they just happened to get played on some stations up north.
Hey, pretty baby, are you ready for me? Yeah, it's your good rockin' daddy down from Tennessee. I'm just that often bound for San Antonio with the radio blasting and the bird dog on. There's a speed trap with my head sound my town, but no local yoga gonna shut me down. Cause me and my boys got this rig unwound, and we'll come 1,000 miles from a guitar jam. Nothing ever happened around my hometown. I ain't kinda just hang around. But I heard someone calling my name one day, and I followed that voice down a lost highway. Everybody told me you can't get far on $37 in a Jap guitar. Now I'm smoking in the Texas with a hammer down and a rocking little combo from a guitar town. Hey, pretty baby, don't you know it ain't my fault? I love to hear the steel bells humming on the asphalt. Wake up in the middle of the night in a truck stop, stumble in a restaurant, wonder why I don't stop. Well, I gotta keep rocking while I still can. Got a two-pack habit and a motel tan. When my boots hit the boards, I'm a brand new man. With my back to the rise, I make my stand. Hey, pretty baby, won't you hold me tight? I'm loading up and rolling out of here tonight. One of these days I'm gonna settle down and I'll take you back with me to the guitar town.
Steve Earle's Guitar Town from 1986, part of Southern Rock Gold. And now, here's an in-the-studio world premiere exclusive. It's the title song to the unreleased Outlaws album, written and sung by Huey Thomason just weeks prior to his sudden death in September 2007. This is Always an Outlaw.
He's been known to lose more than he wins. He falls down just to get back up again. When he smiles, his face is weathered and leathered and loud. You can tell he's learned to laugh through a lot of hard times. He gets by without shelter, a drifter and a dreamer. He gets stoned on a roll your own. What you get is what you see here. Once a cowboy, always a cowboy. Between the blue sky and the above ground, he wears his freedom like a crown. Let the whole world around him change. That don't mean a thing. Once a cowboy, yeah, always a cowboy. She tries to tell him he's running out of time, but that ain't what you'd see if you were looking through his eyes. He's still chasing sunsets, still trying to find something better than what he left behind. She tries to love him, but somehow she understands that it was over the moment it began. Once again.
when we win, we fall down just to get back up again. Once an outlaw, always an outlaw. Between the blue sky.
That was an in-the-studio world premiere. The title song to the unreleased Outlaws album, written and sung by the late Huey Thomason just weeks prior to his death in September 2007. That's Always an Outlaw. Rest in peace, Huey Thomason. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this.